in 2020, about a year and a half later, we closed our Series A round for $10 million, and that was led by Signalfire.
Mon nom est Antoine Gagné et je vous souhaite la bienvenue au 50e épisode du podcast Hypercroissance. Avant d'écouter l'épisode d'aujourd'hui, je vous invite à vous abonner sur Spotify, Apple Podcasts ou sur votre plateforme de balado préférée afin d'être notifié des nouveaux épisodes qui arrivent tous les lundis matin. Également, l'épisode d'aujourd'hui est présenté et produit par G7 Media, une agence de publicité Facebook. En gérant fièrement plus de 1 million de dollars de publicité Facebook par mois, G7 Media aide depuis 8 ans maintenant les entreprises à accélérer leur croissance via l'entremise de la publicité Facebook et Instagram. Si vous désirez être au courant des meilleures pratiques dans l'industrie en ce qui concerne la pub Facebook, je vous invite à écouter le podcast Social Selling qui est mis en ligne tous les mercredis matin. L'équipe de G7 Media vous livre chaque semaine des études de cas réelles qui vont pouvoir vous aider à améliorer les performances de vos campagnes. Aujourd'hui, j'ai la chance de recevoir un entrepreneur américain qui n'a pas froid aux yeux pour le 50e épisode d'Hypercroissance. Sina Mobaster, co-fondateur et chef des opérations chez Tapcart, une entreprise technologique qui aide les commerces en ligne à bâtir leur propre application mobile, va nous raconter comment il a été capable, en pleine pandémie, de compléter une ronde de financement de 10 millions de dollars pour son organisation. En plus de Tapcart, Sina nous raconte ses premières expériences entrepreneuriales. En 2008, il avait eu la chance de lancer l'application PopQuiz, la 258e application sur le App Store à l'époque. On discute donc également de la différence dans le milieu des applications mobiles entre 2008 et 2020. Sans plus attendre, ma discussion avec Sina Mobaster. Sina Mobaster, you are the co-founder and COO of Tapcart, a SaaS company that helps e-commerce owners create their own mobile app. At the moment we're recording this podcast, you now have more than 1,000 customers who use your services 3 years after your foundation. You also raised $10 million in your Series A last May during the peak of the pandemic. Sina Mobaster, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Antoine.
Sina, the goal of the discussion today is to understand the different challenges that you can have when you want to do a Series A in the middle of the pandemic. But before we get there, can you walk us through the beginning of your entrepreneurial journey?
Absolutely. I would suggest that it started probably when I was, 13 years old. I was building computers, selling computers. I was doing computer consulting throughout high school just to make some money on the side. So, printing out postcards, putting them on people's cars, seeing if anyone needed anything that I could help out with. And it was a good way to kind of get introduced to business. Found out that, quickly that IT consulting wasn't my, or like hardware consulting and setting up networks and stuff wasn't my ultimate passion, but it was just good to kind of get a sense of what business would be like and the importance of marketing and how you do it. I would say the actual kind of entrepreneurial journey started back in 2008. Things were, I created one of the first iPhone apps back on the App Store. Once I saw Steve Jobs' announcement of the iPhone back in 2007, I just fell in love with the device. I thought that there was going to be a huge future for it. They had rethought how mobile phones should be used. They really asked a lot of critical questions that other companies at the time weren't asking, such as, do we need all these hardware buttons? Do we need a QWERTY keyboard permanently sitting on the entire bottom, front half of the phone? And at the beginning, there was actually a lot of criticism about their software keyboard. It wasn't the greatest. It could have been better. There were a lot of, autocorrect memes as they were getting that kind of, working a little bit better. But once they released the iPhone App Store, they actually announced it in late 2007. Initially, the App Store was just first-party apps created by Apple. There was a, jailbreak community that had launched because I wasn't the only person who loved this device. There were a lot of developers out there who started to create apps for it and started to, take advantage of being able to jailbreak iPhones. So that allowed you to load, third-party apps onto the iPhone. And ultimately, I think this really captured Steve Jobs' attention and the Apple team. They thought that they could build a pretty strong, they could leverage their strong developer ecosystem through WWDC and all of the developer outreach that they had done over the years for the Mac. So a lot of people were clamoring for this, and they created an SDK, and they launched the iPhone App Store in March of 2008. I took advantage of the SDK. I went on Elance at the time. It was one of these, you know, one of the original, you know, remote working places where you can connect with freelancers around the world. So I put up a project to have this Objective-C app created, put up another project to have a bunch of, you know, test prep, or sorry, some, it was a pop culture trivia game. So I was had a bunch of pop culture trivia questions created in the hundreds. Then I hired a designer. These are all in different countries around the world. I think the designer was from Canada. They made some incredible designs for the app. And in March of 2008, I launched one of the first iPhone apps. It was the 250th app on the App Store. Now there's over 4 million, I believe. It got a ton of downloads. Even back then, it was getting, you know, it was a top 10 iPhone app. It was getting tens of thousands of downloads a day. It was actually higher in the free tiers than that, you know, free top apps tier. It was higher than Facebook, higher than Google. So showed me that a lot of people like pop culture trivia. And it was fairly successful. It was a free app, but it was getting, you know, tens of thousands of downloads a day, even in the first year of the iPhone. And I didn't do a whole lot with it in terms of generating revenue. I released a paid version, but things were very different back then. There were no in-app purchases. There were no ad networks. And people were a little bit more hesitant to purchase paid apps back then. So monetizing was a little tough, but I was also working full-time at the time at the VA Medical Center. So I used that experience. And then in 2009, my cousin, Mike Ghaffari, who's a venture capitalist up in Silicon Valley, he had just graduated from Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School, and he was preparing for the bar exam in California. And he noticed that you know, everyone was paying close to $5,000 for a stack of books that was, you know, weighed about 50 pounds. And they rented you an iPod Touch. They didn't give you even give you the Touch, just to listen to lectures. And we just felt, you know, this stuff isn't copyrighted in any way. It's just the law, and we can create our own course for it. So he linked me with Mehran, who is my co-founder at BarMax, which then became TexMax. And we released the first bar exam prep course for mobile devices. It was for the iPhone. And then the week that we launched, Steve Jobs went on stage in January of 2010, and he announced the iPad. And obviously, we got, you know, very excited, because this was an opportunity to, you know, really turn this business into something big. And because of the larger screen size, and because it was on an iPad, there's really only so much that you could do on an iPhone. And we knew that. And even though there had been some hints of the iPad coming out, or like a tablet device, we had just really designed this for the iPhone in mind. Multiple choice questions, listening to lectures, et cetera. And there were some paper notebooks that came along the way. So we put that together, built that company into a very successful company. I had an exit opportunity in 2014, which I took advantage of. I wanted to pursue some other passions. And then I did consulting for a couple of years, where I met Eric, who's my co-founder now at Tapcart. We met at Coloft. It was one of the original co-working spaces. This is back in 2012. I was running TestMax. He was running his agency, Mobile First Studios. And we just, you know, quickly became friends. We'd go and, you know, grab beers occasionally and, you know, talk about business. And we rekindled that back in 2015 when I went back to Coloft and he was still there. So we would, you know, grab beers every couple of weeks, complain about our clients on the agency side, and, you know, really talk about how we can build something scalable. And he showed me this initial kind of V1 alpha of this product called Tapcell that he was working on the side. And he was really, you know, Shopify just released their mobile SDK. Back then they were, you know, 100,000 stores. Now they're over 1 million. And we thought it was awesome. It's a great way to connect to Shopify stores, just like the website pulls all this data from your Shopify dashboard. You could do that now in a mobile app. And really, I just kind of bugged him and bugged him for the next year to start this thing on his own, because I really saw a lot of potential in it. So I just kept doing that, kept the conversation going. He continued to kind of iterate on that initial alpha version. And before you knew it, he kind of came to me and around Thanksgiving of 2016 and said, you know, he wants to kind of work on this thing with me. And he realized that, you know, it was going to take at least a two-person endeavor to really work on this, to get the sales right, get the product right, get the marketing right. But we did it, and we kind of worked without a salary for for several months. And then in April or so of 2017, we officially launched TapCart. And, you know, we used various technology profilers to kind of get a list of Shopify stores that were out there. We just used whatever we could. We were still bootstrapped at the time, so we didn't have a lot of money to work with. And we did a lot of kind of organic methods, one growth hack after another. And we ended up bootstrapping for about 6 months until we raised our first fundraising round, which is a convertible note round led by Luma Launch for, and that was in June of 2017. For $285,000 total.
Okay, so this is a great intro. I think in like 9 minutes, you've been able to tell me so many great things. I just want to go back to a couple of very interesting topics. You mentioned 2008, POP Gaming. That was the name of your first app, correct?
That was called Pop Quiz.
Pop Quiz, okay, perfect. So between this app that you launched in 2008 and TestMax, I think that you exit the company in 2014, but basically I think you built this company 2010, 2011. What was the big difference between marketing both? I know that Pop Quiz was clearly more maybe a sideline project, not necessarily a business that you wanted to pursue that much. But can you explain to me a bit the difference in marketing an app in 2008, 2012, 2013, 2014, and then obviously we'll go back to 2020 after?
Sure. Back then, honestly, it was just easier to market an app. There were only a few hundred apps on the store, but there were, you know, already hundreds of thousands of iPhone users. And because it was a free app, people love downloading free apps. So, you know, I put the app out there. I reached out to various blogs that were covering the iPhone and the App Store ecosystem that was just launching. Reached out to him. I let him know, hey, this is a game I'm working on. It was one of the first games. Some of the apps were, early apps were very utility-based. Some of the big players got in. So Google was there, Facebook. So there weren't a lot of games and people just love playing games. So I wish I could take all the credit for its success, but I think it was just, you know, got lucky and did something in an industry that people were really clamoring for. They wanted to find a way to just, you know, lose some time on their phone, and because it was just always with you. So yeah, there's a lot of kind of gaps throughout people's day that they want to consume with something. So this kind of fit that kind of product and market. But monetizing was really tough. So there were, and even getting app installs was not easy outside of these few methods, because there were no, if I wanted to do paid social, there were no app install ads back then. There were, you know, very few.
There were no Facebook ads, I think.
There were no Facebook. Yeah, there were probably no Facebook ads. I think Instagram ads launched in 2015, but Facebook ads, I don't know the year, but they're very, could not have, very well could not have been Facebook ads even. So what was the difference in 2010 is we had a very defined audience. It was, you know, all law students who were in their third year of law school. It started in California. So there's quite a few law schools here in California, and it was just kind of a very direct sales approach, a little bit old school too, because law school is a little bit outdated, I think. And there were still, you know, bar review weeks where the, you know, four main bar review companies would go on campus, you know, twice a semester and set up a table, and law students would walk by and we'd have, you know, materials we'd give them, all kinds of swag, merchandise, et cetera. So a very, very different approach than your typical kind of startup company.
Very interesting. And then you mentioned later on you co-created TapCart, and then you said that you bootstrapped the company for the first several months, correct?
Yes, that's right. So we bootstrapped the company from November of 2016 when we first started working on it to our first round, which is in June of 2017.
Very interesting. And back then, because I want to know a bit what kind of dynamic, what kind of vision did you have at that point with TapCart? You're with your co-founder, you're bootstrapping this project that you have. Do you already go and get some employees, or do you already have the technical expertise to build the app yourself? What is your role? What is the role of your co-founder at that time?
So, you know, we're both founders. He's the CEO, I was the COO, and we are to this day. He had some talent that was working with him. So he had one iOS engineer and one designer from his agency who we kind of brought over and transitioned over to TapCart when he ended up closing down his agency. So between him and Eric, they managed to get, you know, the product in a good state on the iOS side. We had a very talented designer as well who would help with various assets for the app, various assets for, you know, advertising and marketing, et cetera.
Interesting. And then you mentioned that a couple of months later, you did your first convertible note that you did. And from the moment you have this money coming in, what have been your first steps? Did you hire different people that you wanted absolutely in the team before? What has been the first move that you and your partner did at that time?
It was definitely bringing on some talent. It's a very product-driven company, TapCart is to this day. And we wanted to bring on more engineers, more designers, to really get the product in a place that it could kind of sell itself in a way. Shopify has a very healthy developer ecosystem, and you know, we love being their partner. So TapCart is, you know, it only integrates with Shopify at the moment. That'll change in the future, but that's kind of how it is right now. And they send us quite a bit of business from our presence on the Shopify App Store. So that's really what we did at the beginning to, you know, really hit the ground running once we raised that first round.
It's a good partner to have.
Absolutely.
You know, so having Shopify, it's always a good thing. Je fais une petite parenthèse sur le podcast en cours afin de vous remercier tous et chacun qui nous écoute. Vous êtes des milliers chaque mois à écouter Hypercroissance et ça me touche du fond du cœur. Également, si vous connaissez quelqu'un qui aurait sa place sur le podcast pour nous parler d'hypercroissance, je vous invite à m'écrire personnellement au email suivant agang@j7media.com. Donc A-G-A-G-N-E, A commercial, J, le chiffre 7, media au singulier.com. Et ça me fera un énorme plaisir de discuter avec vous. De retour à l'épisode en cours. I'm always curious, Tina, to know the different growth phases in a company. So sometimes a company will start and they will need to do different things to reach the first half a million in revenue, the first million in revenue. Basically, usually there's a lot of different growth phases in a company. Can you explain us today the different growth phase that TapCart had in the past 3 years now, and also how you've been able to overcome each of these plateaus? Because sometimes we reach a specific plateau and we need to do different things to make sure we get to another level.
Absolutely. We had to start somewhere. So we started when we launched back in April of 2017. We managed to get customers, you know, the very first week that we launched. We didn't even have a product at that time to sell. We were kind of selling a vision and selling some screenshots. But it was essentially pre-selling TapCart, knowing that, you know, our customers knowing that it was going to be available in the coming weeks or month. So we just really, you know, got this list of stores. We really just kind of did it the old school way, I would say, of, you know, directly contacting through cold outreach these stores. So we used technology profilers, like I mentioned. BuiltWith is a great one. They'll tell you the various technologies on pretty much every website that you'll want to get that information on. So they go through, they have a bot that, you know, they crawl these sites, they go through the source code, they extract different parts of the source code that tells them they're using Shopify or they're using Magento or they're using WooCommerce. And through BuiltWith, it's very easy to get these lists. So we got the list through BuiltWith. It told us about the Shopify plan they're on. It told us they were on Shopify. And then we would just use other tools. So it was just kind of going from one tool to the next to then get, you know, the email addresses of those stores. There's a lot of different tools that you could use for that. We used Hunter. I think they're based in France. And they are an excellent tool for just, you know, really dumping a bunch of domain names in a CSV. You can upload it to Hunter. And it'll give you what it thinks are the best email addresses for both general purposes, like info at, contact at, sales at, or specific kind of, you know, higher level people who work there. So they've got a huge database. It kind of guesses the emails. So you still want to run their validation tools to make sure the email isn't going to bounce. Because if you bounce a lot of emails, it's not good for your domain reputation. And it's just not a good practice overall to send a bunch of, you know, spam and emails that don't work. So we made sure the emails were accurate. We would look the people up and we would send the store owners directly. Or if they had an e-commerce manager, we would send it to them, depending on the size of the store. And we would just pitch TapCart in a couple of sentences, just plain text, really simple. And we started sending these emails out in bulk, a few dozen a day to start. And then, you know, beyond that, a little bit more than that. And it was just a very non-spammy looking approach where we really just tried to provide value and tried to explain to them what, you know, really address their pain points as a Shopify store, which is, you know, it's pretty clear. It's, you know, retention, it's increasing customer lifetime value, it's reaching their customers, not rocket science, but it's something that people will listen to if you have a solution that could work for them. And what we pitch to these brands is the ability to build an owned marketing channel. Owned marketing is essentially a marketing channel that you have control over from end to end. So examples of these are, you know, email, that's an owned marketing channel. SMS is an owned marketing channel. Facebook Messenger is an owned marketing channel. You might think, oh, it's Facebook, but you control the messages that you send to the individuals that have subscribed to your list. So typically when you have a list and subscribers, that would be an owned marketing channel. And in our case, it's a push notification owned marketing channel that gets enabled through the mobile app. So by having an app, you're going to inevitably get people to download it. There's a lot of different ways to promote your app. But once you have those downloads, over 60% of people opt in to receive subscriptions and push notifications, essentially, from these mobile apps across specific industries. So some in more industries than others, but fashion and apparel, beauty and cosmetics, food and beverage usually have very kind of rabid fans and people that follow brands pretty strongly. So the ones that download the app, if you position it the right way, if you message it the right way and explain the value of why you should opt in to push notifications, people who are strong fans of the brand are going to be willing to do so. But how you do it is very important. So if you just, you know, I'm sure you've seen a lot of apps where you install them and they'll show you the loading screen and then immediately they're asking for your location. They're asking for access to your contacts. They're asking for you to opt in to push notifications. Back then, it happened a lot more than it does now because people have kind of learned over time that you need to provide some value before you can get people to agree to that. And people have become a lot more sensitive of which notifications they allow, which permissions they allow, especially on the privacy side with locations. But back then, it was a little bit different. So people would just ask for that value immediately. And like, you know, they ask for those permissions immediately and they don't provide the value for it. So we don't immediately ask for it. We show a little kind of soft pop-up at the bottom that'll activate the original Apple pop-up. And if they kind of close that out, we'll ask them later on in their shopping experience. We'll explain exactly what it does. If you want to get, you know, shipping notifications, if you want to get to be the first to hear about new products and promotions, if you want to get exclusive mobile app related discounts. So if you ask it that way, people will be a lot more willing to do so. And especially now, since Apple has made it so easy to deliver messages quietly, people are, you know, a little bit more open to doing so. So that's kind of how we got started. And then in terms of the second phase, kind of that 500K to a million, you know, obviously it was faster than getting from zero to 500, but we continued some of those same methods. And then we started to incorporate social media marketing. We created a blog on our website with a lot of valuable organic content that these stores would provide valuable. And we would send our leads content. We would send them, you know, we didn't try to be very salesy. We wanted to just provide them with value first. And then they're going to naturally ask about what TapCart is.
Interesting. And you mentioned Shopify is your main partner. That's where TapCart is integrated. How Shopify has been able to help you while you were growing? Did you see that compared to 2017, you now receive way more business from Shopify since your app is more mature, since your SaaS, let's say, is more mature, since you have more case study, proof of concept? How this partnership evolved with time?
Well, it absolutely has. Earlier on, back in 2017, the Shopify App Store was a lot different. They completely redesigned it, I believe, in 2019. And it was a lot more driven towards discovery of apps, added new categories, added easier navigation to see new apps. They also added a lot of things that have helped us and other Shopify partners, such as delivering, you know, there were pop-up messages and notifications that'll appear on your Shopify dashboard, on the home screen of it, that kind of gives you a feed of what's going on your store. So it'll tell you, you know, today's sales, it'll tell you what your best-selling products are, and it just continues to provide kind of like a Facebook-ish feed of just things that are related to your store. It'll tell you what marketing and referrals channels are working best, but it'll also say, hey, because you've installed this app, you might want to try this app. So if you have, you know, one of our competitors' apps installed, it'll suggest that you install TapCart and vice versa. If you have TapCart installed, it'll suggest you try one of the competitors. And I think that's a great thing because I think people, I could be a little biased, but I do think we are the best solution out there. But if, you know, our app store rating isn't enough, if our app listing isn't enough, then it's, you know, an opportunity that Shopify presents and allows for discovery. And more people are willing to try out the apps across different competitors in the same kind of industry. So a lot of that, we also managed to become the initial mobile app partner for the mobile app sales channel for Shopify Plus. So we became a Shopify Plus certified app. Of the, you know, thousands of apps on the Shopify App Store, only about 36 apps were initially launched and vetted as part of the Shopify Plus, which is their enterprise plan, the Shopify Plus certified app channel. So that made a lot of these bigger stores more comfortable with installing TapCart. They knew it wasn't going to affect their website, or it wasn't a buggy app that was going to mess up on them. And because it is a sales channel, you really have to make sure that you can build that trust, because this is a representation of the store. This is a representation of the brand, and a brand is a promise. And if you mess with that brand, and if you offer an off-brand experience that doesn't look good, doesn't perform good in the mobile app, then the brand isn't going to want to have that for very long. The customers aren't going to like it. That's going to hurt their brand equity. So brands are typically, you know, it takes some time to build that trust. It's not like installing an app that'll, you know, on your website that'll kind of ask for emails, or if you put your mouse off of the browser window, it'll do an exit intent pop-up just to, you know, see if they can at least get that person to be added to the email list instead of just leaving a website. So it's a lot more than that. And it is a storefront, and it quickly becomes, if it's managed well and promoted well, the second highest performing sales channel after the online store, which is the website, which is installed with every Shopify store.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Sina, you raised $4 million in 2019 and $10 million in 2020. What were the big difference between these two rounds? Did you have way more traction in your last round? Was it easier since you've been able to do it in the past? And now VC were more confident in your company. What has been the big difference between these two rounds?
I would say it starts with the money. The amount that we raised is very different.
Of course.
But you know, all jokes aside, we raised in... the $4 million was raised with Greycroft as the lead investor back in late 2018. And we had a, you know, really cool product to show with AR functionality. You could, you know, see virtually how that pair of shoes would look on your desk or on the ground, you know, next to your feet. You can try on an outfit. You can try all these different things. And it was a very cool demo that we did with Fashion Nova, which was augmented reality. So we had a bunch of products 3D scanned. We made a product discovery tool in the app, and it looked really cool, and the company was growing, and it was in a great industry. Shopify was really starting to pick up traction at that time. And, you know, e-commerce was hot. It's obviously hotter than ever right now. And mobile apps were really picking up steam as well. So that really helped us out, along with a very lean company that didn't have a lot of overhead, didn't spend a ton on marketing, and had a very strong team with a very strong product. Credit for that goes to Eric and the team that we built. So we had some good momentum in 2018, but one piece of advice I would give is to don't get frustrated during a fundraising round. If you have to knock on dozens or even hundreds of doors to get a meeting or to get that first term sheet, because it's a process, and there's a lot of diligence involved. There's a lot of traction you have to show, and understandably. And we use some of our strong relationships and introductions that were made from our previous two rounds prior to that. And our investors really opened a lot of doors for us. In 2020, about a year and a half later, we closed our Series A round for $10 million. And that was led by Signal Fire. We the week of March 9th, we just before COVID hit, we decided to go up to San Francisco to go meet with some investors. There was some interest because they had been asking, some investors had been asking our current investors for intros. We had a really cool product. Product was getting better. We had some other ideas that we wanted to go with beyond just mobile apps, which we're working on now. And we had a vision. And with all of that kind of traction from Shopify and from the business and from our growth that we had sustained for the first, you know, 2.5 years, we went out and Signal Fire provided us with a term sheet that week, soon after our meeting. We had a really great meeting with a lot of data, a lot of things to show, a really clear, you know, roadmap of what the future is going to look like. And it takes a lot of people to get that term sheet, but you know, fortunately, Signal Fire shared our vision. And, you know, I think they realized very smartly that COVID is going to strike a lot of different businesses in a lot of negative ways, especially if you're in retail, especially if you are a movie theater chain, especially if you are a hair salon. But they, you know, quickly realized that e-commerce was likely going to grow from this and it was going to accelerate. So I hear various numbers, but it looks like, you know, e-commerce in the last 6 months or 8 months since COVID hit has actually accelerated at a pace that would have previously taken about 5 years. So good industry, e-commerce, more people were, you know, on their phone than ever. More people were still shopping, especially from their favorite brands. And we provided that opportunity for some of these brands to, you know, instead, if they had a retail storefront, they can kind of hedge or leverage that with a mobile app. And a lot of stores that didn't, you know, weren't on retail, they were starting to look for less expensive options to engage their customers. And, you know, going back to what the company provides, is provides the ability to create that owned marketing channel of push notification subscribers, because it was getting more expensive than ever to market on Instagram. The more successful you are on Instagram, the smaller, you know, naturally, the smaller a percentage of your followers, your organic posts are going to be seen by. Back when I was doing social media marketing in 2015, doing some consulting, there were no Instagram ads. There were, Instagram was all about engagement. Facebook wasn't concerned about monetizing Instagram. So what ultimately happened is a ton of these businesses went on. It was, you know, a great way to just not do a whole lot, just build a profile, post some pictures, and have all of your customers follow you and be able to essentially get free marketing on Instagram. Back then, if you put out an organic post as a business, that means a non-paid post, they would show it to close to half of your followers for free, if not 60%. And now for a lot of businesses, that number is down with all the companies advertising on Instagram, which is in the millions, with all the money being taken from old billboards and TV ads and all that being funneled into Instagram. That's 50, 60% that they would show organically is now maybe 3 to 5% for a lot of stores out there. So that's an obvious pain point because posts are simply not being seen. And if you do advertise, and you know, you have to basically pay to play if you want your post seen. So if you do want your post seen by 50% of your followers or 20% or 30%, you have to pay Instagram each time you want that done. So, and they make it very easy. They just say, you know, here's the analytics for this post. You can tap here to boost this post and pay us $100. We'll show it to, you know, 15% of your followers. Pay us $150. We'll show it to 30% of your followers. And it just gets more and more expensive the more followers you have. So it's not a really sustainable, it's a great marketing channel and people should continue doing what they're doing on Instagram, but it's good to, it gets people to want to really leverage that.
Just one thing, paid advertising, I think, is really valuable if you use it to build what you call your own marketing asset. So basically, you use paid advertising to build, I don't know, an email list. You use paid advertising to build having people who download your app. All the different marketing assets that you own, you should use paid to bring these people in these environment, because after that, you own these assets.
Exactly. So you want to get people on your email list by offering a giveaway of an ebook or a free gift with purchase, a free gift with shipping, for example. Just give us your email. So a lot of people use these very kind of lightweight solutions to provide some value. You pay less because it tends to convert a lot better than your typical conversions ad, which is going to send someone to a product on your website and you hope that they purchase it. In a lot of cases, you haven't really built enough brand value and brand equity to get someone to trust you to do that. And it's just gotten astronomically more expensive than it was even a couple of years ago. So what happens is a lot of these brands are frustrated by that. And instead, like you mentioned, they're getting people to just install their app. And you can do a mobile app install ad now. It's not much more expensive than just driving someone to your website. But the great thing is you only pay when somebody installs your app and opens it at least once. So that's the way through the Facebook SDK that, you know, they know that somebody has actually installed one of the apps in an app install ad, because Apple doesn't provide them with that data on an individual level. Apple will tell you how many, and Google will tell you, you know, how many downloads you got in one day, but they're not going to tell you who downloaded it or their device IDs or their emails or anything. So Facebook has to insert their SDK. And when that SDK gets pinged from an app install that they knew that they drew, that's how they credit you for it. So it's really beneficial in three ways, I think, over your typical paid social ad. One, you get someone to install your app. So you get a little piece of real estate on their phone, which is excellent. Two, you get to offer them a better experience, in my opinion, than the Instagram in-app browser, which I think it's a little clunky. If you swipe down or up too much, it can close the whole window. And it's just not the greatest experience, at least compared to a native mobile app where there's no loading times and things like that. So you get to get the app installed, you get a better experience, and more likely than not, they're going to opt in to receive push notifications eventually. So now you get to market to that person essentially for as long as they have your phone on their device, which tends to be a long time. A lot of people accumulate hundreds of apps even. You should see mine. I have like thousands, but it's my business. So, you know, they'll do that. And then you can market to them again and again, just like you mentioned with email. You can do that through push notifications through our platform. Someone can just go to the TapCart dashboard, which is embedded in your Shopify dashboard. And you can type in a message, choose one of your products. You can send them animated lookbooks. You can send them, you know, push notifications that have product images in them, in the push notification itself. So imagine like an animating lookbook on the home screen or the notification center of your iPhone. Looks really cool. At least compared to like the 99% of push notifications that are just text or emoji based. So I think those are the three kind of primary ways. And through that, we were able to really sell the vision and sell the dream of why you should really invest in this own marketing channel of push notifications, because it's going to take a little time and it's going to take a little effort. But it's really, in my opinion, the best way to sustainably grow an e-commerce brand. Because you get these push subscribers and now you're sending push notifications. We don't show it to 5% of your followers. You know, you always get it seen by 100% of your push subscribers, and you can send them at no extra cost on the platform.
You're good at selling it. You're very good at selling it.
It just makes sense to me. I don't know. It's, you know, it's a lot easier to have conviction and have a good way of selling something when it's actually something that makes sense.
Of course. And also it helps a lot of businesses. You have more than 1,000 customers now. So it's working very, very well. And also, I just want to go back to one thing. You raised $10 million for your Series A during the last pandemic. Question for you. How did you do that? Like, have you been able to have these different agreements before the shutdown happened? Everything was done through Zoom, because usually when it's that amount of money, the investors, the VC wants to meet you face to face. So now clearly, if it was during the pandemic, you cannot do that. So how this negotiation, these different agreements, how this whole thing happened?
So back, yeah, it was the first week, or it was the second week of March. It was March 9th that we went up there. And fortunately, there wasn't, you know, a stay-at-home order at that time. We were getting very close to it, especially up in San Francisco. So that week, I would say, you know, a bunch of our meetings got canceled. VCs wanted to kind of wait it out. And a lot of them weren't working out of the office, but some were. And Signal Fire was. And we met with, you know, a handful of other investors as well. And what we did is we went there with a very strong presentation. We had some traction to show. And we were growing and we had a vision for what we wanted to do in the future. So despite you know, COVID kind of being on the horizon and a lot of unknowns out there, we managed to get that in-person meeting. We got a term sheet soon after the meeting, and we had a follow-up call that was a video call done that Thursday. And, you know, Signal Fire really believed in us and the product and the future and the vision that we were showing, and we were in a good industry. So they wrote us a term sheet soon after the meeting. That doesn't guarantee a closed fundraising round by any means. There was still, you know, another meeting. There was still, you know, several meetings after that, a lot of diligence that was done. But we closed the round in late April and we announced it in May.
Oh, so just before. It's perfect, right? You did all these meetings just before this shutdown happened, so it's great.
Got very lucky. If we had gone even a week later, I think we might not have even gotten that first in-person meeting.
Exactly.
With anybody for that matter.
Yeah, and that's where it becomes way more difficult. I was talking with people. Clearly, it happened. People got their investment, but they were telling me that it was way more challenging. Way more challenging because it's not small checks that you're getting, right? $10 million, you want to meet the person, you want to see the vision, you want to understand with who you're working with, right? So yeah, it's interesting to know that. And before I ask you different questions, personal questions, do you think that in the near future, let's say the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years, do you see that most of these e-commerce owners will also own a mobile app like most of these e-commerce owners own an email list right now?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the biggest pushback that we got throughout, you know, from the time that we started this company, from merchants who, they always loved the product and they just didn't believe that anyone was going to download their app. They may have, you know, personally hated downloading apps, or they didn't trust themselves enough or have enough kind of confidence in themselves that they'd be able to get their customers. Even all you really need, you don't need to get all your customers to download the app. You just need to start just your best customers. And it's not that much of an ask if you can provide something that, you know, typically would cost at least several hundreds of thousands of dollars to build and would take over a year. The quality of app that you can get with our platform is up there with the biggest, you know, and best apps in the world, so, especially on the e-commerce side. So it was something that, you know, they got the product, they got the experience, they got how it was better than their mobile website. It loaded instantly. It just looked good. Checkout converted a lot better, but they didn't believe that anyone was going to download their app because of their own personal beliefs. So what we did is we, you know, eventually kind of proved to them over time, we really pitched them on not just the experience, but focusing on that, creating that own marketing channel, and that being a great way to really invest in your own business, invest in your own brand. And with new technology, such as something released in iOS 14 called App Clips, it actually allows you to do streaming mobile apps now from a website or an NFC tag or a QR code or a few other ways that they're eventually, you know, essentially popped up. You can basically just tap a button and stream a part of the native app to provide that initial experience and to provide that value without them having to even go to the app store or download or install it to their phone. So with technology like this, we're obviously very excited about that. And we're building our own app clips. We wanted to, you know, it really allows a lot more people to become interested in mobile apps because it gets over that biggest piece of friction that we've always gotten about, you know, why would anyone install my app? Well, you can show them directly with a button on your website and they can start streaming your app.
Very cool. See, now before I let you go, how people can know more about TapCart, know more about you. Here at J7 Media, we are bringing clients to your app right now because we think there is a lot of value here for e-commerce owners. But for other people, how can they know more about your company?
So you can visit TapCart.com, TapCart.com, or visit the Shopify App Store and search for TapCart. You can view our website. And if you're interested, if you have an e-commerce store that's on Shopify, you can book a demo and we're happy to show you the platform.
Yeah, very cool. Sina, thank you very much for being with us today. I think it was very interesting to know how to raise this amount of money during a pandemic, understanding a little bit the future, how you see the future of e-commerce with mobile apps. So I think it was quite fascinating. And yeah, for people who are listening today, see you soon for a new episode. Bye-bye. Je suis toujours excessivement fasciné par les entrepreneurs qui ont choisi de croître leur entreprise via des investisseurs externes. Cette avenue plus risquée, certes, mais également plus rapide, témoigne souvent du désir de l'entrepreneur à passer en hypercroissance encore plus rapidement. Du côté produit maintenant, j'invite l'audience aujourd'hui à utiliser TapCart. On est nous-mêmes en train de le tester chez G7 Media et je n'ai que des bons mots à dire. Également, si vous connaissez quelqu'un qui aurait sa place sur le podcast pour nous parler d'hypercroissance, je vous invite à m'écrire personnellement au email suivant agang@commercialj7media.com. Donc A-G-A-G-N-E, @commercialj, le chiffre 7, media au singulier, monnaieantoine.com et ça me fera un énorme plaisir de discuter avec vous. Je termine en vous invitant à nous donner une note de 5 étoiles sur iTunes ou sur votre plateforme de podcast préférée. Vos commentaires sont également très appréciés. Sur ce, on se dit à bientôt pour un prochain épisode de Hypercroissance.